We're doing a series on parables, and today we're going to read the parable from Matthew chapter 13, verse 24, the parable of the wheat and the weeds. That's the NLT caption. So here's the story that Jesus told, and then he gave an explanation of it, and we're going to meditate on it. Here's another story Jesus told. The kingdom of heaven is like a farmer who planted good seed in his field. But that night, as the workers slept, his enemy came and planted weeds among the wheat, then slipped away. When the crop began to grow and produce grain, the weeds also grew. The farmer's workers went to him and said, "Sir, the field where you planted that good seed is full of weeds. Where did they come from?" "An enemy has done this," the farmer exclaimed. "Should we pull out the weeds?" they asked. "No," he replied. "You'll uproot the wheat if you do. Let both grow together until the harvest. Then I will tell the harvesters to sort out the weeds, tie them into bundles, and burn them, and to put the wheat into the barn." Then verse 36. Then, leaving the crowd outside, Jesus went into the house, and his disciples said, "Please explain to us the story of the weeds in the field." Jesus replied, "The Son of Man is the farmer who plants the good seed. The field is the world, and the good seed represents the people of the kingdom. The weeds are the people who belong to the evil one. The enemy who planted the weeds among the wheat is the devil. The harvest is the end of the world, and the harvesters are the angels. Just as the weeds are sorted out and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the world. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will remove from his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. And the angels will throw them into the fiery furnace, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in their Father's kingdom. Anyone with ears to hear should listen and understand." I love living in the suburbs. You know, when I drove to church this morning, as we do from White Rock, I drive past hay fields and blueberry fields and gardens, vegetable fields, and I see tractors and cultivators, and I just love that. All that while being only minutes away from world-class shopping malls and first-class business towers. It's the best of all worlds. Well, living in the suburbs was something like the world in which Jesus lived. Yes, there were villages, there were cities, and there were towns, but they were connected by the vast countryside. And so when Jesus told parables, he often used agricultural parables. And he assumed that everyone in his audience would be able to relate to the lessons that come from agriculture. And so we have an agricultural lesson before us here today. The parable today is quite different from the one we looked at last week. If you were here last week, you will remember how I somewhat euphorically introduced it by saying this parable is great and glorious, and everybody should respond in like kind. Well, today I can't use that by way of introduction here, because this parable strikes a very somber and solemn tone. And so, but still, it has some very necessary information for us. And if we want to have a healthy spirituality, which I'm sure we all want to do, then we better factor in the information that we have in the parable before us. And so, being a long weekend, I thought we might take just a little new approach here. And I want you to all come with me to the craft room. We're going to do a craft together. And the craft that I'm proposing we do You heard me read the story. How about we make some wall plaques? Just a little, and summarize the key thoughts of this message in wall hangings that you can put up in your hallway or in your kitchen or in your bathroom so that you can be reminded of the main lessons of this parable of Jesus. Since it's impractical for us to really do that, and since I had the advance notice of this craft, I'm going to share with you with what I came up with in the craft room by way of wall plaques. Well, here was wall plaque number one that I designed, and it is, "Don't expect life to be trouble-free." That's one of the lessons that comes right off the top in this parable. And it's an important lesson. You know, I have sadly listened to people from time to time be very bitter about life. And they tell how the woes they've had and how nothing has worked out for them and all the hardship and the unexpected problems. And they just are so angry and bitter and life is going by and they're missing out on the enjoyment of life. It's as if they had the expectation that life, they had an entitlement of a trouble-free life. And so I think to be forewarned is to be forearmed. We should not expect life to be trouble-free. Anyone who seriously studies the New Testament or the Bible understands that we're going to have difficulty. This world is filled with problems and difficulties. In Kids Club, at Kids Life, Kids Camp, I guess it was, Kids Camp, we learned one of the memory verses was, "In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world." And I was delighted to have a lesson series that had that realism built in so that the children from grade 5 and from kindergarten to grade 5 We'll memorize a verse, "In this life you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world." Well, one of the teachers kind of emailed a bloopers around of reciting memorize. One of the children recited it as, "In this world you will have trouble, take heart and overcome the world." And that's really the message that is there for us, right? Because Jesus has overcome the world, we kind of share in that the victory of Jesus. And so We read this parable, and we understand where the problems come from, where the trouble. We look at the world, we get asked, why is the world in such a mess? Why do we have such poverty, the homelessness? Or you can look further afield, like Assyria and Egypt and Ethiopia, and you name some horrible things happening in the world. Why is the world such a mess? Well, whatever answer you give, it has to take into account the answer that Jesus gave. The devil is the enemy. And he sows seed. He tries to disrupt God's blessing. He tries to diminish the value of life. He tries to diminish the value of God's plan and tries to deceive people. One of the great ironies of life that I have observed is how many people reject belief in God because of the evil in the world. They say, "Well, you know, I can't believe in God because of all the evil in the world." When the truth of the matter is, if it wouldn't be for God holding back evil, we'd all be destroyed by evil. And so the truth of the matter is, it is easier to explain evil with God in the picture than it is to explain all the good in the world without a God. See, not only where does the evil come, but where does all the good come from? All the beauty. It comes from God. So if you ask, what is the main driving force behind the alleviation of poverty and of sickness, building hospitals around the world and the schools, overcoming illiteracy and mitigating all manner of human misery, I believe the correct answer to that, it is the Christian church over the centuries. But that fact has been underreported and ignored in the secular media, and so we almost are not aware of that. But I think if you do the research, you'll find out how true that is, that God, in this evil world, has produced a lot of good and motivated a lot of good, and so we celebrate that goodness. So the first key thought here is the thought of the devil is the one who promotes and destroys. Like as we read in John chapter 10, verse 10, you know that verse keeps coming up. And I know it's a verse that it's been in some of the literature from the start of Coast Hills Community Church. Is the John 10:10 says, the thief's purpose is to steal, to kill and destroy. My purpose is to give them a rich and satisfying life. So the crop growing up was supposed to be an abundant crop, and that was God's plan. Then the evil one comes and ruins it by putting noxious weeds in it. So we have to come to terms with the work of the evil in the world. Now, in Genesis chapter 3 in the Bible, we read how Satan introduced evil into human existence by tempting Adam and Eve, and they fell, and somehow that distorted the human DNA. And so ever since then, all people were born with the potential and the tendency toward evil. And so as a result of that, the evil in the world is no longer all directly perpetuated by the devil, but people do it, and people make choices. And so the terrorist activity that we see in this parable is now perpetuated by evil people who make bad choices. And so out of a combination of the natural, fallen nature comes evil, and directly from the evil one also comes this. So let me just refer to some verses on spiritual warfare. We have to come to terms with there is a real devil, and he has limited powers, but he has the ability to distort life, so we have to be on guard. 1 Peter 5:8 says, stay alert, watch out for your great enemy, the devil. He prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. So it says stay alert. And how do we stay alert? Well, I would think, the basics, the 101 every day declare yourself as a servant of God and invite God to direct your life every day. You start the day and say, Lord, I want to walk with you. I want to just do your bidding. We stay alert by reading the Bible. And so 2 weeks ago, we handed a few words here. You missed out getting a nice little devotional book, Jesus is Calling. You can have a devotion of just reading. Be alert by reading, being alert by praying, being alert by being part of a Christian fellowship group, a life group, or just to stay alert to kind of nurture your spiritual life. You can stay alert, I guess, by playing Christian CDs as you're driving along or listening to Christian radio when you're driving. And I have to confess that has not been my practice, and I sometimes feel a little guilty about that when people tell me they're driving listening to preachers on the radio, and my excuse has been, well, I don't want to live in a hothouse. I have to preach to people in a real world, and so I listen to talk radio and hear about all the junk and all the fluff that they come up and all the entertainment of news. But lately I have once in a while turned on carry radio, so don't write me off just yet. I might come along and start listening to Christian radio. But staying alert, there are a multitude of ways we can do it, and God wants us to do it. Now, in the parable, it says, while they slept, the enemy came and sowed the seed. So interesting applications have come out of that. Dr. David Avert, who is one of our own Mennonite Brethren scholars, has a commentary on this book. And Wayne has it in his library, and so I used it, and it broke in half, Wayne. Sorry, it kind of ruined it. It hadn't been used for so long. It was dried, and I went crunch. Cheap binding on that one, but it's got good stuff in it. David Avert says that one of the Spanish Jesuit read this line while they slept, And he says it's the bishops of the church that are sleeping. And he got into hot water with the Roman Catholic hierarchy over that interpretation. That didn't go over so well. But it's always so much fun to blame management, isn't it? The person above you, and to make fun of them. I heard about a pastor who somewhat self-righteously and maybe egotistically said, I never go on vacation because the devil never goes on vacation. And which someone just countered by saying, is it your policy to take the devil as your role model? And so that kind of took some of his pride out of the equation. The truth of the matter is, what's the lesson here? While they slept, correctly interpreted, it says in the natural flow of life, they're not blamed for sleeping. In the natural flow of life, the enemy came. And so it was not a punishment. This farmer has done nothing wrong. It's just kind of a random way in which the devil tries to ruin that person. It is my observation that trouble and difficulty in life is distributed somewhat randomly and very unevenly, I might say. But we have to be prepared for that. And we have to take our stand and realize that whatever falls in our path, whatever difficulty or problem or unexpected disaster falls in our life, God in that moment will offer you grace to get through it. In this world, you will have trouble, but take courage. I have overcome the world. God's going to be with you. He's going to help you. And so we don't have to crumple in a heap and start feeling sorry for ourselves and getting bitter about it. My favorite verse in the spiritual warfare category is 1 John chapter 4, verse 4. And I'm sure many of you will immediately recognize it because it's such a comforting verse in dealing with the devil and the demons and all that evil force out there. 1 John 4:4 says, greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world, which is Jesus is greater than the evil powers. Jesus is in us. We do not have to live in fear. James 4:7 says, submit yourselves to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. No one needs to feel worry and live in fear of what the evil one is going to do for them if they are walking with God, because God has the power to deal with that and will. And so we have this warning. I don't know how you feel oppressed. Maybe you've been dealt some setback. Somebody's been sowing weeds in your fine crop of life and you feel down. Just take courage. God wants to be with you. And sometimes it takes longer than we want to solve the problem. So in this example, the workers are wanting to address it right away, and the farmer wisely says, no, we have to wait. And so sometimes it'll take longer, but don't lose heart, don't lose courage. Okay, that's wall plaque number one. Don't expect life to be perfect, but know that God is with you in the midst of all the imperfections. Wall plaque number two, don't judge others, judge yourself. And here are the verses. An enemy has done this, the farmer explained. Should we pull up the weeds, they asked. No, he replied, you'll uproot the wheat if you do. You know, isn't it a fact that a lot of the hatred against Christians comes from the fact that they appear to be judgmental? We've often communicated kind of a judgment, we've got the right way and you don't have the right way. You know, it's one thing for us to have confidence that we are on a path of walking with God and have eternity. You don't have to say you're not and you're going to go to hell. That doesn't necessarily follow, and it certainly it takes away the sting of that judgmentalism. And so we have here some interesting lessons, and I'm going to throw these out to you, and you can check it out and sort it through and see the Bible to make sure that what I'm saying is on track. The one of the lessons from this is the lesson of coexistence. You know, you don't always know, number one, the weed that was so that is common in this area of Palestine was a weed that was indistinguishable from grain in its early stages. So as the crop started to grow, you couldn't tell which is the good and which is the bad. But once it went to seed, once it headed out, then you could tell which was the weed and which was the good grain. And so one of the lessons is there has to be a willingness of coexistence. We have to be willing to coexist with those who don't. And when the farmers want to root it up, he says, no, don't do that. We'll just wait. Christians need to come to terms that we live in a pluralistic world, and we should not be distressed about it. Psalms 34 says, fret not thyself because of evildoers. Now, I think lots of times Christians are far too worried about all the evil when God tells us not to worry about it. We should worry about our walk with God. When we come to communion today, there the passage of 1 Corinthians says, but let a person examine themselves. Examine. It's our role to make sure we're walking with God and we don't have to necessarily be concern ourselves with the other. Now, I have to be careful with that. We still want to be share the goodness of God and encourage people to come. And it does not mean that we shall not do evangelism. And so if you ask someone where they are and they're standing with God, I don't think that's judgmental if you don't do it in a loving way. And if you do it in a way of wanting to help them to move forward wherever they are in their walk with God, recognizing that we're all on a spiritual continuum. And so rather than seeing it as wanting them to be on the one side of the continuum rather than edging them forward. And so it does not preclude having spiritual discussions with people. I did a wedding recently and I hadn't met the groom. The bride knew me from my former church and was happy that I was able to do it. And met the groom for the first time preparing for the... And I asked him, are you a follower of Jesus? And he enthusiastically responded, yes, I am. He says, I'm not only a follower of Jesus, Jesus lives in me. I've accepted him and invited him into my life. I thought, what a great answer. What a great answer. Just to be so interested. But in asking the question, are you a follower of Jesus? It was not a judgmental question. It was just a discussion question to help assess where they are and to give them the appropriate guidance for their married life together. Because in marriage, you know, building a marriage on a spiritual basis with God at the center, it is just such a great resource, and it's so much easier to walk forward with that foundation than it is not to have that foundation. Well, the not judging has a variety of applications, and Jesus said, judge not, lest you be judged. And so there is some pretty significant potential here for discussion. One of the ways in which it could be applied is in church discipline. Church discipline means the accountability that we have in the local church. And what do you do when someone steps out of line? It seems to me that the enthusiasm for church discipline in this narrow sense of the word, the interest and enthusiasm for it has dissipated over the years. I remember when I grew up in rural Manitoba, on a few occasions, people were actually summoned to appear before the church board to give account of themselves because they had violated one of the church taboos or rules or God's principles. And this parable kind of sheds light on what you can expect when you get too zealous on that path. And my summary of it, an observation of it, usually when those situations resulted in more damage being done than good. Because in this case, don't worry about being overly zealous in trying to root out evil, because you might damage the good crop in the process. And so I think church discipline, let me just explain what my view of church discipline is. I think church discipline is the work of every member of the church. And it happens, I think, effectively, or most effectively, when it is done in peer relationships. It's horizontal. When it's horizontal, not hierarchical. And so we have church discipline in the sense of discipling one another in our fellowship groups. As we chat coming into church casually, we tell each other our stories, and we exhort each other, and we admonish one another, and we encourage one another, and we call one another to certain paths. That is, I believe, the foundation of church discipline and the best church discipline. And that's not to rule out that when it comes to leadership selection, that there has to be some pretty solid delineation marks where judgment and discernment has to be applied, and leaders are held to a higher account than the rank and filed, and that's a scriptural principle, and so I recognize that. And so we have this call here about the not judging and about judging ourselves and being prepared. So I guess it is a reminder for us to review how are we coming across. Do people find us judgmental? And let's just be more like Jesus and say we don't always have to know where other people stand. It's certainly not our task to judge them and to pretend we know where they're going to end up in eternity. Which leads me to my wall plaque number 3. A final judgment awaits everyone. Now, I mentioned earlier that this parable has a solemn tone, but it doesn't get any more somber than the words that we have about final judgment. And the passage is there, and we've read it, and don't need to reread it all. But it reminds us that God doesn't settle accounts every day and every week or month or year, or sometimes God doesn't even settle accounts in a lifetime. It seems that some people live sinful, godless, cruel lives and get away with it, and they prosper all the while, while others live dedicated, loyal to God, and kind and gentle and self-sacrificing, and their life is filled with grief and hardship. And so what's with that? This parable answers that question, that objection. Wait till the harvest. Wait till the harvest. A day of reckoning is coming. There is a heaven for the godly and a hell for the godless. Now, speaking of hell, which we don't do that often, it is described in this parable as a place of burning. And so obviously there's pain, and Dr. David Averitt in his commentary says it is a place of pain and rage. The gnashing of teeth, he thinks, as rage and hopeless despair. He also mentions that in Matthew chapter 8, verse 12, heaven is referred to as a place of outer darkness. So we have to realize that when the Bible speaks of hell, it uses highly pictorial language. And so I think it's best for us not to get too dogmatic or dramatic in our descriptions of it. We know that there is a real place called hell, and that it is highly undesirable to end up. Now, we can look at the example of Jesus, as our example here. And I would say that Jesus did not rush around frantically trying to rescue people from hell. Now, he did refer to it from time to time, but that was not the message that he gave. It was not a threat. You go to hell or you come follow me. No. He invited people kindly and gently. If you want to have your spiritual thirst quenched, follow me. If you want to have your spiritual hunger satisfied, come follow me. If you want to have peace and rest, come follow me. That was the basis of his call. Maybe you've heard the statement, which I have heard, that Jesus referred to hell more often than heaven. Well, I've heard that people say, but it's wrong. That's not true. And it would immediately, if you've read the New Testament, you say, well, it doesn't ring true, does it? No, it doesn't. It's not true. And I read a researcher who was addressing this says that he did a study of it, and did a count of it, and the score between heaven and hell of Jesus' references, heaven 127, hell 27. So over four times as many references to heaven as there are to hell. And so we know that no person needs to go to hell because God offers salvation to all. No one will be there because their sins were too big to be forgiven. The Apostle Paul saw himself as the worst of all sinners, and yet he found grace. Now, people will end up in hell because they reject God and God's way and prefer the devil as their master. Now, how that is exactly going to be all sorted out with those who have never heard about Jesus, we don't have to, the Bible doesn't really address that definitively. And so we don't have to render a harsh judgment on that, but we need to joyfully proclaim the good news that Jesus is the one who brings us salvation. And that's what we deal with when we do in communion. And we're going to conclude our service here in communion today. In communion, the cup, which symbolizes the life of Jesus, the blood in his veins symbolizes the life of Jesus, the bread symbolized the body. He was real. It wasn't imaginary. A real body, which is broken to us. And so, symbolically, we express our union with Christ. We express his presence with us. We express our gratitude to him, and we express our acceptance of the forgiveness that he provided by dying for us. Now, if you're here today and you're not sure whether you qualify for communion, we have an open policy. You have to decide. You have to discern that. And our understanding is that communion is for those who are on the pathway of having committed their life to Jesus, having said yes to Jesus, and want to follow Jesus. Now, if you've never said yes to Jesus, the communion service is also an evangelistic service. And you could say yes today, right now, in your heart, and then take the cup, take the bread, and say, yes, Jesus, I want you to be in my life. I want to follow you. And so you could take that. And then, of course, we would encourage you to declare that and follow through and make this a sincere turning point in your life so that you will have a sense of confidence of where you will spend eternity, which this passage reminds us of being such a real issue. So as we come to communion, I'm going to ask that servers will come and stand here, and then we will come forward, and you will come and get the cup. It's a double cup. And so in the first cup is the juice, and below that is a wafer. And so you can just tip that. And so Kim and Amarjeet and are going to come and stand as the stations. And I want to thanks Heinz to so if let's stand as we and I'm going to have a prayer, Lord, as we move to this part of the service. We respond by saying thank you for salvation. Thank you that we don't have to worry about eternity. We know that your salvation guarantees for us to be with you in eternity. Lord, help us to be the people that you want us to be. And as we dedicate these moments and this time, well, I pray that you would sanctify the cup and the bread, bless it to our spiritually and strengthen our resolve, Lord. Give us insight. Fill us with the love that you want us to have for everyone. In Jesus' name, I pray. Amen. So please come forward and collect the cup and go back to your, and we'll partake of it together.